Now then, if you have your syllabus, open it up to page 91 for a minute while we get oriented here. Page 91. Left-hand side of that page. Where we left this off last time was with Jeroboam, the son or grandson of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. Now let me tell you, that sin was not forgetting his morning devotion, although I suspect he was guilty of that too. It was putting up these golden calves to attract people's worship. This was the sin that made Israel a sin. Now you notice that this northern kingdom was extremely unstable. They had 19 kings in a little over 200 years. And in nine dynasties, of which the longest lasted 88 years and the shortest 7 days. And part of these we'll simply skip. They're not particularly important. They're only sort of connecting links in the chain, as far as we're concerned. There's Jeroboam, the first one. He's the guy that picked up the 10 pieces of the ripped robe and so forth, and then went to hide out in Egypt, you remember. He reigned about 20 years. His son Nadab, 2 years, and that was that. Next dynasty, 24 years, Baasha and Elah, and we'll skip them completely. The next dynasty, Zimri, 1 week. At this time, there was a three-cornered power struggle going on with three men with somewhat similar names, Zimri, Omri, and Tibni. And each of them wanted to be king and would like to have the other two liberated from this world. And for a while, Zimri got a hold of power, but he only held it a week when he was murdered. Well, he was in a house, and his enemies told him to come out, and he said he intended to stay inside, so they burned the house down, and he was burned to death. And that was that. The next king was Omri. Now we come to where we'd be today. The Omri-Ahab dynasty. This fellow Omri was a wicked man, but he was a man of ability and energy and potential and got a lot of things done. In the Bible, he only writes one short paragraph. Now, you see, the Bible is history, all right, but it is very selective in its treatment of subject matter. It is not simply history in general or a general explanation and account of everything that happened, but it is focused quite sharply on, let's say, the kingdom of God and the plans of God in this world. And Omri was not, he didn't rate very high on that. But from the worldly standpoint, he was important. And he, of course, is a part of the continuity of this kingdom, so he is put in with a paragraph in the Bible, gives the main facts about him. Internationally, he was a great guy. Here at Nineveh, capital of Assyria, way inland on the Tigris River, inscriptions in cuneiform script have been found which refer to Israel as Bit-Homri. This means the house of Omri. Even after he was dead, they called the land of Israel the house of Omri. What would you think if the newspapers in London and Paris would refer to the United States as Nixon Land? Or a few years back, let's say, we'll not favor any party here, Johnson Land. They called Israel Omri Land. And even after he'd been dead quite a while, they still called it Omri Land. Now, this indicates that even though, let's say, he wasn't much of a Sunday school scholar, he did put his imprint on world history in a political way. Among other things, Omri arranged a marriage for his son Ahab. Now, marriages used to be arranged by the parents. Would it be a good idea if we go back to that system today? I won't ask for a vote on this in this class, but I'm afraid well, it would have to be modified. It couldn't be worked absolutely. But in Bible times, this was a regular thing. Parents planned the marriages. Yeah, Miss McCree. In Cyprus? They do. Does it work all right?
Well, they need to marry, and I was trying to get away.
Why, you came to America?
Yeah.
All right. I see. Well, let me tell you, in China when I was there, young people who are college students getting educated, They have dates and get engaged and so forth, just like we do. But they go through the forms of pretending that they've never met before the wedding to please the old folks. And I actually heard of a case that everybody knows, you know, it's stage acting, but they go through the old form. A case, this was told me by a senior missionary, a young fellow in a somewhat backcountry part of China. Parents had arranged him to get married to a certain girl, and he said to his father, "I won't marry her unless I can see her at least once." So the father said, "This could be arranged." So he took him to the girl's house, and they sat down and drank tea and visited with her parents and didn't see the girl. And finally, the girl's father said, "Well, I'll let you look at her." So they went to another room and opened the door, and there she was, sitting stiff as a statue on a chair at the back of the room. And the girl's father said, "There she is. Will she do?" "Yes, she'll do." Now, that was told me for something that really happened. Even for China, that's a little bit extreme. All right. Omri arranged a marriage for his son Ahab, and he had him marry the daughter of Ethbaal, king of Sidon. Now, Sidon was one of two cities, Tyre and Sidon, both of them just ruins today. The country, however, is what is today called Lebanon. Lebanon, and the capital today is Beirut. And Tyre and Sidon are both just ruins or dead cities, archaeological digs. But at that time, they were busy, important cities. Lebanon had Phoenicia, it was called, had just a little slice of back country, and it had its outlook toward the sea. They sailed the Mediterranean clear to up to what is today Cornwall in England, where they loaded up with tin and brought it back to the Near East, where it was sold at a handsome profit and used to alloy with copper to make brass or bronze. And they also sailed down the coast of Africa as far as the port of Dakar, where Africa sticks out farthest toward South America. And there's some evidence that sometimes they even sailed clear around Africa. Now, these people were sailors and they were traders. They were rich. They were very prosperous and wealthy and very wicked. And their religion was a form of Baal worship, Baal Melkart. B-A-A-L-M-E-L-Q-A-R-T, also spelled M-E-L-K-A-R-T. Baal would be a perfectly neutral word. This simply means Lord or Master. But it came to be the name of the special god of these people. Baal Melkart worshipped a fertility, sex, and nature religion, worshipped with rites which were both immoral and obscene, and this abominable practice of infant sacrifice. Take a little baby and burn it alive as a sacrifice to the gods. That's what these fellows did. And this is where Jezebel, the daughter of the king of that country, comes from and becomes the bride of Ahab, the son of Omri. Now, her father was Ethbaal, king of Sidon. Notice the name of the god Baal compounded into his name. He may have been a priest of this religion as well as king of that country. Anyhow, that's where she comes from. Do you suppose she was pretty or good looking when they had married her? Well, this is uncertain. Anyhow, she came to Samaria and married Ahab, and this is still several years before he became king. His father wasn't dead yet. Now, Jezebel was a go-getter. She's an extrovert. There's nothing introverted about Jezebel. She had Ahab wound around her thumb. One of my former students put this on a paper as a character sketch. Ahab was the husband of Jezebel. She had a domineering personality, and she henpecked him something awful. And this is true. Ahab pretty much did what Jezebel said. I attended a wedding in Beaver Falls here where the officiating clergyman got panicked and mixed up and made the groom promise to obey the bride. And this occasioned a good bit of kidding afterwards. Especially the groom got kidded. "You promised to love, honor, and obey this woman." Well, it wasn't any joke in Ahab's case. I don't know if he loved, but he honored and obeyed. Joseph. All right. She comes to Samaria and later Jezreel, which was the branch capital, sort of the summer White House of this kingdom. Omri dies, Ahab becomes king. Now you remember Solomon married many foreign women who had false religions, and they demanded little tolerance for the faith of their childhood, and little idol shrines for the religions of Solomon's wives went up around Jerusalem. This was off limits for Israel. It was just for the king's wives, but of course it had an influence anyhow. But please note, none of Solomon's wives was a promoter of a false religion. All they wanted was live and let live just for me. And none of them is on the warpath to promote a false faith. All they want is just to worship as they believe. But Jezebel is a promoter. And she succeeds in getting the religion of the Lord deposed, and it becomes an underground movement. And the religion of Baal Melchart is adopted, officially sanctioned by the government, and becomes the official established or state church of this northern kingdom. And people that wouldn't knuckle down to this kind of tyranny, she persecuted viciously, and many were killed, died a death of martyrs. That's Jezebel. So things are pretty bad here. Now you see they have gotten rid of the religion of the Lord, or driven it underground. They've got two religions left. There's those golden calves that Jeroboam put up. Those are still in business. And then there's this imported religion from Phoenicia of Baal Melchor. And this, the country's gone hog wild to pick this up, as promoted by Jezebel. Now, of course, this is wrong. And it's contrary to God, and displeasing to him. And God, in his moral government of the world, has to do something about something like this. So the prophet Elijah appears at the court of Ahab. Now, Elijah's name means Jehovah, or the Lord is my God. He is a mysterious figure. Elijah the Tishbite. This means Elijah from the town of Tishbe, but nobody knows for sure where Tishbe was. Apparently, however, there is some evidence that was in the wilder country on the other side of the Jordan River, on the east side of the Jordan, Transjordan. Elijah the Tishbite, he scorned the refinements of a wealthy and cultured society and lived a simple and almost ascetic life, and he would appear from apparently nowhere, speak his peace for God and bear his witness and get up and leave again, and nobody could find him until he was sent again by the Lord to go somewhere. So Elijah the Tishbite appears at the court of Ahab, and he says that God is angry because of what has been going on here, especially Jezebel and her doings, and there will be no rain until I give the word. Now, you realize Palestine is a country of marginal rainfall, and even in a normal year, they have just barely enough water. And if the rain fails, it's critical. No rain until Elijah will give the word. Of course, Elijah doesn't have the power to prevent rain. He is only speaking for God here. He's merely an announcer. Now, it doesn't rain. They've had many long droughts in the Holy Land, and this is perhaps, I don't know if it's really the longest on record, but it didn't rain. Maybe there were longer ones. They had them today even sometimes. 3 years and 6 months before it rained again. Of course, there was some water. The people would all have soon been dead. There was water in the Jordan Valley and in the bottom of the larger streams that were fed from high mountains further north, and some wells. But there was no rainfall on the land. The grass wouldn't grow. And if you plant wheat or barley, it won't grow either. It just dries up. The land is baked and cracked. I've seen land like that in the western part of our country during the Dust Bowl years. So 3.5 years. And all this time, Ahab is blaming Elijah for this. And I presume Jezebel is needling Ahab to catch Elijah. But he blames Elijah for this. Instead of thinking, well, what about our sins? No, blame the prophet. But he can't find him. Elijah is successfully hidden, and Ahab can't get him. And the 3 years and a half go by, and things get really bad. And finally, Elijah appears at the palace of Ahab and is met at the entrance by a man named Obadiah. This is Ahab's steward or business manager of his household. Obadiah, whose name means servant of the Lord. He's on Ahab's payroll, but he's servant of the Lord, and he really was a servant of the Lord. In fact, he had some opportunities to serve the Lord that he wouldn't have had if he hadn't been connected with Ahab's palace there. Go tell Ahab Elijah is here. Sir, do you want me to lose my head? There's no place where he hasn't searched for you. He's even sent to foreign countries to try to get you arrested. He blames you for the drought. He's very angry about it. And I go tell him Elijah's here, and as soon as I get inside the door, the Spirit of God will pick you up and drop you over across the Jordan or someplace, and when he comes back, you won't be here, and then it'll cost me my head. Now, Elijah swore an oath. This is not a profane oath. This is a solemn oath. Jezebel had one, too. I'll tell you about hers later. Elijah swears, "As the Lord God of Israel liveth, in whose presence I stand, he will see my face today." This is his way of hitting a nail on the head and driving the point home. "As the Lord God of Israel liveth, in whose presence I stand, he will see my face today." So Obadiah goes and tells Ahab. Ahab comes and speaks to Elijah. "Are you the guy that is troubling Israel?" Now, let me tell you, that's not the way to talk to the reverend clergy. But Ahab does it. And Elijah doesn't take it off him. He throws it right back like a ping pong ball. "I'm not the man that troubles Israel. You're the man that troubles Israel. And that queen of yours, Jezebel. Ahab, I want you to go to Mount Carmel and hold a big mass meeting." And he names him the place and he names him the time. "I want you to be there. I want the prophets of Baal to be there. I want the prophets of Asherah to be there," called in the King James Version the Grove. I'll explain them in a minute. "And I want the people to be there in a large mass meeting." And he names the time and the place. "Goodbye, Ahab." And Elijah vanishes. Now, the Grove. This is a word that was not understood when the King James Version was made 300 years ago. Hebrew word. This should be translated Asherah. A-S-H-E-R-A-H. It's the name of a goddess. The wife and or sister of Baal. She is ambiguous as to her relationship there. Wife and or sister. Don't expect a heathen myth to be logically consistent. She is worshipped by stylized slender images like poles stuck in the ground. And this is why they got the idea of calling it the Grove. But her name is Asherah, and she is the female counterpart of Baal. And this is the ladies' auxiliary of the Baal religion. Extremely popular with the women, and if anything, even worse than the religion of Baal, if that's possible. All right, now Ahab has no choice. You know, kings and queens, as long as everything's prosperous, they're sitting fine, riding high, wide, and handsome. But everything goes bad in the country. Here they're faced with famine on account of drought. And the kings have to watch their step or they don't sit very securely. So Ahab has to do it. And he calls the meeting, and everybody goes. Jezebel doesn't go, but he goes, and the prophets of Baal and of Asherah, 800 and some of them, they are all out there. These prophets were imported from Phoenicia. They're not a native product. Jezebel imported them. And the people go. They can't farm the land. Everything's baked and hard. There's nothing will grow. They can't plow or plant, and so they might as well go to this too. They get there, up in Mount Carmel. Sticking out toward the Mediterranean Sea there, that promontory on the coast. Great crowd. And Elijah starts the proceedings as, "How long are you going to halt between two opinions? Have it both ways." There was a political party once in early American history called the Mugwump. Somebody said a mugwump is a bird that has its mug on one side of the fence and its lump on the other side. Try to have it both ways at once. Or somebody said you could try to ride a horse in two directions at once. How long are you going to try to have it both ways? If Baal is God, okay, let's settle our religion and worship Baal. And if the Lord is God, let's worship the Lord, but quit hesitating between the two, which is what these people have been trying to do, you know. I propose a test. We'll fix two altars and put two sacrifices on it, two slain bullocks or animals, and you pray to Baal, and I'll pray to the Lord, and the God that sends fire will be recognized as God. Now, this is a miracle, and you either believe in miracles or you don't. There's nothing more foolish than to try to explain this naturalistically. It's either a miracle or it's just a fairy tale. I think it's true. In fact, I'm sure it's true. Anyway, Elijah says, I'm in the minority here. Many of you and just one of me. I'll let you have the first go at it. I think at this point the prophets of Baal perhaps secretly wished they were on a trip to Cuba or someplace. But you see, they're surrounded. They can't get away from here. They're on the spot. This is theater in the round. Here are the actors in the drama and this great audience encircling them. Thousands of people. They can't get out. So they have to agree to this. They fix their altar and put wood on it and kill an animal, a calf or a bullock, and put it on a young ox and put it on it. Tie it down, and Elijah watches very carefully to see there's no trickery here about lighting fire to this surreptitiously. Then they start dancing around this, praying, Oh, Baal, hear us! Oh, Baal, hear us! Oh, Baal, hear us! And nothing happens. And this goes on. They keep on and on doing this and getting louder and louder. And finally, Elijah starts to make fun of them. Now, ridicule is not considered ordinarily a proper method for evangelism. But Elijah was led by the Spirit of God, I'm sure, and knew what he was doing here. And he rubs it in. Pray a little bit louder. He's a god, isn't he? Maybe he's asleep having a siesta. May have to wake him up and tell him somebody's praying to him. Maybe he's out for a walk and they have to send out and find him. Maybe he's in another part of his grounds and has to be paged. Pray a little bit louder. He's a god. Now the prophets of Baal don't think this is funny. But you can imagine the grins and snickers and suppressed giggles on the part of some of that audience in the background as this happens. And they take out little knives and start to cut their wrists. Now you have to do this carefully. You cut the wrong way and you'll bleed to death. You're going to cut your wrist to bleed. You have to do it very selectively. But they do it. And the blood starts to drip. This is putting a compulsion on Baal. If Baal doesn't send fire after they do this, he's not living up to the code. And so they cut themselves and the blood drips and they get going around faster and faster and shouting louder and louder and in a higher and higher pitch. So they're in a wild frenzy. I heard Adolf Hitler once on the shortwave radio. It was my favorite form of lawbreaking, just before World War II in China. And he spoke for an hour and a half on the Berlin radio, which we could hear, the shortwave equipment, what he's going to do to England and France. And this was plenty. He talked an hour and a half. And he started out in an ordinary tone of voice, and as he got going longer, He got to talking faster and louder and in a higher pitch. Till at the end of that speech, when he finally got to the end of it, he was shrieking and screaming like a crazy man. I never heard anything like it before or since. Adolf Hitler and the way he screamed. Well, the prophets of Baal are like this. They worked themselves up into a wild frenzy and dripping blood and dancing around there, and no fire comes. Finally, Elijah beckons for silence. All right, it's my turn. They subside, and no doubt would have gladly gotten away from there fast if they could have, but they couldn't. All right, my turn. He fixes an altar for the Lord, and what he does here is symbolically involved 12 large stones to make this altar. This reminds them of the ideal 12-tribe unity which they have shattered. Now, I explained last time it had to be shattered, but still it was the shattering of an ideal. It was something that stood for something good and right that had to be broken, you see. So this was an evil from one point of view. 12 stones. Then he chooses the time. It's noted particularly in the record, the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice. This is the exact time of day when far away in Jerusalem will be offered the true sacrifice by the true and legitimate priesthood in the true temple of the Lord according to the true word of God, which these people have cut themselves off from, you see. The time of the offering of the evening sacrifice. Now Elijah prays, and it's a quiet prayer, none of this noisy stuff like they had, that God will turn the hearts of these people back. And the fire comes and burns up the sacrifice. Incidentally, just before this, Elijah had barrels of water poured on. He had men go down the mountain to the Mediterranean Sea at the bottom and get up barrels of water and pour it on here, so they'll see there's no Houdini-style trickery here. This is a real miracle. It says the flames licked up the water in the trench. Now, this may mean it got so hot that this water all boiled away or evaporated. I don't think water can burn, except in miracles, maybe. But anyhow, it burned up the whole thing. And the people shout, "The Lord, He is the God! The Lord, He is the God!" And Elijah says, "All right, take the prophets of Baal and Asherah down the mountain and to the stream at the bottom that flows out into the Mediterranean and kill every one of them. Don't let one escape." And they did. A student once objected very emphatically to this, and I'll tell you exactly what this student said. He used a strange expression. "How awful to kill all those nice prophets." That's the word he used, those nice prophets. And I said, "Death is tragic no matter who dies. Even when a Christian that goes to be with the Lord dies, there's a tragic angle to this. Death is a consequence of sin. In itself, it's a fearful thing. If it were not for Jesus Christ, who has taken the sting and curse out of death, it would be a tragedy indeed for everyone. And when a wicked person dies, that is certainly tragic. But," I said, "while recognizing the tragedy in death, save your sympathy for a better cause. These fellows were the ones that carried out that abominable infant sacrifice. How many babies do you suppose they had burned alive in their false religion?" Elijah knew what kind of people they were. "Save your sympathy for a better cause." And I'm sure God was directing. Now then, Elijah goes up on the top of Mount Carmel and sits down and squats down in the sand or on a stone and puts his head between his knees and starts to pray, praying for rain. You see, the people have said, "The Lord, He is the God." Now he can pray for rain. Now he's got a right to pray for rain. And he sends his attendant or servant to look out across the western horizon. All the weather that brought rain always came from the west, across the Mediterranean and from the Atlantic. Weather from the other direction brought hot, dry winds from the south and east. "Look out to the west. See what you see." This guy comes back and don't see anything. He sends him back 7 times. And meanwhile, Elijah keeps on there with his head between his knees praying. And on the 7th time, the servant comes back and says, "There's a little cloud there about as big as a man's hand. It isn't very big." That's it. So Elijah goes down the mountain partway, meets Ahab and says, "Ahab, get in your chariot and get back to Jezreel before the storm stops you." By this time, the sky is getting black and it's beginning to be thunder and lightning and it's going to be a terrible storm. "Before the rain stops you." So Ahab gets in his chariot. It's 19 miles to go from Mount Carmel to Jezreel. And Elijah does a very heroic but strange action here. He tucks his outer robe up under his belt and runs the whole 19 miles in front of Ahab's chariot. And you might wonder, what on earth is he doing that for? And I think I can explain this to you. Elijah had to make a fool of Ahab on account of loyalty to God. He had to make a fool of him. And he was sorry to have to do it. And glad to bear his witness for God, but, you know, Elijah is not a traitor. He is not a betrayer of his country. He is not a revolutionist or a rebel. He is loyal to the country. And he is showing by this that he is supporting Ahab as king, even though he had to oppose him on this issue about Baal. So he runs the whole way just ahead of the worst of the storm in front of Ahab's chariot. They get there. Elijah goes and puts up at some humble lodging, maybe the YMCA or something in Jezreel, and something comparable. And Ahab goes back to his ranch palace and tells Jezebel what had happened that day. Now she starts to swear, and Jezebel has her oath. Elijah used to say, "As the Lord God of Israel liveth." Jezebel says, "The gods do so to me and more also, if I don't get him as dead as one of them by this time tomorrow. The gods can kill me if I don't kill him by this time tomorrow." That's what she says. Now, look, don't murder anybody, please. But if you ever do, don't notify the intended victim one day in advance. This is no soap. Jezebel was so mad, she sends and somebody finds out where Elijah is staying that night and tells him he's going to be killed tomorrow by orders of the queen. And, of course, he gets up and leaves. Poor Elijah, he was, after all that tension, and then running 19 miles, pretty well tuckered out, and now the queen's trying to kill him, and he gets up and has to flee. Well, he did it, and he went clear through Ahab's kingdom, and then down through the kingdom of Judah, south of that, into the southern Negev or desert, down near Beersheba, and flopped down under a tree, clear, absolutely none in and exhausted, and prayed that he might die. Now, let me tell you, Elijah hasn't lost his religion. I'll tell you what he's lost. He's lost his blood sugar. Elijah is physically and nervously exhausted after all that tension. What a letdown. He's clear done in. And God knew what he needed. He needed food and water and sleep. And he got these, and he was some better. Now, there's more to the story of Elijah, but we'll take up the two incidents in the little time we have left, and I will have to impersonate Jezebel for you a little bit and fill it in with a little bit of, let's say, science fiction in here between the lines. 1 Kings chapter 21, in the Catholic Bible, 3 Kings chapter 21. Ahab has his palace, his branch palace, at Jezreel. And right near that, there's a vineyard that belongs to a man named Naboth. Now, this is an acre or so, maybe, of improved land with a wall around it and a gate. And inside there would be grapevines and berry bushes and probably a couple fig trees and maybe a little herb garden. And this belongs to a man named Naboth, who is a citizen of Jezreel and a godly man. And Ahab wants it because it's right near the property of his palace. So he goes to Naboth and says, "Naboth, my friend and neighbor, would like to buy that vineyard." "Sorry, King, I can't sell." "You can't, why not?" "It's the inheritance I have received from my forefathers. Now, according to the law, property of this type could not really be sold. It could be leased. What was called a sale was really a lease, and at the end of a 50-year period, they had the year of Jubilee, all the property went back to the original owners. How much you would pay depended on how many years there were left to run. So Naboth, however, knows if Ahab gets his hands on it, my family will never get it back, so he won't sell. Naboth, I really need it. It's near my palace. Listen, Naboth, money is no object. You name your price. I'll pay whatever you ask." "Sorry, King. My conscience won't allow me to sell the inheritance of my forefathers." "Tell you what, neighbor, you go find a better vineyard than this. Find a bigger and better one somewhere, anyone you want to pick out. And tell me where it is, and I'll buy it from the owner and then trade it to you for this one. Now, how about that?" "Sorry, King, my conscience will not allow me to sell the inheritance of my forefathers." Now, Ahab is thoroughly miffed and frustrated and disgusted, but he doesn't try to get it by force. He tried to get it by bargaining, and when that didn't work, he didn't try force. Ahab goes back to the royal palace, goes into his bedroom, lies down on the bed, turns his face to the wall, and starts being sorry for himself. A very negative emotion, a fit, the real binge of the royal self. And dinner time comes, and the Jezebel goes to the dining room, and Ahab isn't there for dinner. So she goes looking for him and finds him there in his bedroom, lying on the bed, miffed because Naboth won't sell his vineyard. Now I will impersonate Her Majesty. Ahab, what is the matter with you? Oh, that guy Naboth, one of these religious fanatics, won't sell his vineyard. Starts talking about his conscience, inheritance of his forefathers. I offered him all kinds of money. He says he can't sell the inheritance of his forefathers. Ahab, are you the ruler of Israel? After you, my dear. Listen, Ahab. Kings and queens don't ask people for things. They take what they want. Now, that's the way they did it where Jezebel came from. But that's not the way they did it in the land of Israel. And Ahab knows perfectly well that it's not. Where Jezebel came from, the king and the queen are above the law. In the land of Israel, the law is above them. They're under the law. That's a tremendous difference in your worldview. And Ahab, I say, he's no Sunday school scholar, but he knows this. Ahab, let your little queen Jezebel handle this for you. I'll get Naboth's vineyard for you, Ahab, and it won't cost you one red cent. Yes, dear. Listen, Ahab, let me have that ring off your finger. Yes, dear. So here goes the ring. This is a signet ring. It has a seal on it. You stamp this on something, and it's an official order of decree of the king. He gives this to Jezebel. And you fellas got a signet ring that makes things official. Well, be careful if you lend this to. He gives this to Jezebel. The power of attorney in the king's name. Now, Ahab, let me handle this. You do what I say. Ahab, you go down and eat your dinner. Yes, dear. And I'll get Naboth's vineyard. Jezebel doesn't even bother eating dinner. So Ahab goes to eat. He feels better already. Got that comfortable feeling. The Marines have arrived and the situation is well in hand. And Jezebel goes to the room where the scribes wrote out things and calls the secretary and says, take a letter to the city council of Jezreel. So she dictates, and this guy writes, and she dictates some more, and he writes some more, and to the city council of Jezreel. You get this message, call a meeting, have Naboth arrested, employ two fellows to bear false witness against him that they heard him curse God and the king. Here are two counts. Curse God, curse the king. Each of these in the law of Moses carried a death penalty. Stone him to death and let me know when it's over. Signed Ahab, not just Ahab, and sealed with Ahab's seal. And this was sent by a special messenger to the chairman of the city council. They have a meeting. Now they should have, they read this, they should have torn that up and sent back word and said, Your Majesty seems to be under a misunderstanding. This is the city council of Jezreel, not the Jezreel branch of the mafia. We do not murder one of our own fellow citizens. But, you know, they carried that order out. Maybe they didn't like Naboth. Maybe this good man was sort of a standing rebuke to some of their sins. Poor Naboth is arrested and framed and doesn't have a chance. These two witnesses swear by the name of God that they had heard him curse God and the king, but it's a lie. They had to throw the first stone, and then all this crowd of people threw a shower of rocks, and Naboth is dead. And word goes back to the royal palace. Naboth is dead. Now, just imagine a little bit here between the lines. Let's suppose this is Ahab and Jezebel's wedding anniversary. There's one chance in 365 that it was.
And that Jezebel goes to see Ahab in his official headquarters. Ahab, anniversary gift from your little Queen Jezebel, Naboth's vineyard. Ooh, thanks. So he's got Naboth's vineyard. He says, please, there's a little boy with a new toy. Ahab goes to look over Naboth's vineyard. And he goes there and goes through the gate. Nobody challenges him. Nobody there. And walks up and down between the rows of grapevines and berry bushes. This place is wonderful vineyard. There's no weeds growing in there. It's been cultivated with a lot of horticultural TLC under loving care. And Ahab is very pleased with it, and he's very pleased with Jezebel for getting it for him for nothing. And he goes back and forth and turns around and faces back toward the gate again, and who should he see but the prophet Elijah standing at the gate. Oh, what's Micah, you know? And Elijah confronts him. Ahab doesn't get to say a single word. Have you killed and also taken possession? When did Ahab kill? Killed when he took that ring off his finger. That's when he killed. Listen, Ahab, message from God to you in two parts. This is part one. Right by that pond where Naboth was stoned and the dogs licked Naboth's blood, the dogs are going to lick your blood one of these days. Yes, sir, your blood. That's part one. Part two, not very far from that same spot, the dogs are going to eat Jezebel up to buy it. And Elijah went away. Now, you know, that sort of took the fun out of getting Naboth's vineyard. Especially since Ahab knew Elijah was a prophet of God, and it was pretty likely it would come true. Now, we just got time to show how that prophecy came true. Time went by. Ahab should have known if it was really a prophecy of God. He couldn't block it, but he tried. Here, there's been bad relations for many years here between the kingdom of Judah and the kingdom of Israel. Maybe a good bit of guilty conscience on both sides of the line, and a state of cold war. All the hatred and bitterness and occasional raiding and kidnapping and once in a while some real fighting. And this has been going on. From the time of Jeroboam down to the time of Ahab. Now Ahab figures it's time to stop all this and bury the hatchet and have peace. But peace on his terms. His kingdom is the larger and more prosperous and richer and more important of the two. So he invites Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, from Jerusalem up there on a royal visit. Jehoshaphat is a descendant of David, a good man. His main fault was he found it awfully hard to say no. But he's invited up there, and Ahab butters him up. You know, this powerful King Ahab is flattering this king of a smaller and less powerful country. And winds him and dines him and entertains him royally and gets him all of influence. And here they're having a ceremony in the gate of Jezreel. Here are two thrones. Flags waving, you know, and the musicians playing and everything. We celebrated the ceremony and pomp. And Ahab leans over to Jehoshaphat and says, my brother, just watch out. He calls your brother or sister. My brother. There's a wicked man calling a godly man, my brother. Ramoth Gilead. On the other side of the Jordan River, by right, belongs to my kingdom, but the pesky Syrians took it. Later they promised to give it up, but they wouldn't. And I can't get it back. Now, if you'd join forces with me, we could put on a combined expedition, and it would be a cinch. We could get it. Will you go? Why, certainly, Ahab. See, he's buttered up till he feels he can't say no. Then Jehoshaphat has second thought. Ahab, I'm not in the habit of starting something like this without trying to find out if it's the will of God. Haven't you got a prophet around here, prophet of the Lord? Oh, Jehoshaphat, prophet. That's what we got. Nothing else but. Officer, bring the prophet. So an officer goes out. 15 minutes later, he comes back with 400 of them. Left, right, company, halt. These are the prophets. Not prophets of Baal, these are prophets who claim to be prophets of the Lord. But there's a awful point. God hadn't sent them. But they claimed to speak for the Lord. So here they are, 400. Gentlemen of the clergy, shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall we stay home? And they reply in one voice, a well-rehearsed and built speech chorus, go up and prosper, the Lord will deliver it into the king's hand. The siege of us says God is in favor of it. Yes, Ahab, I heard your prophets, but somehow I'm not impressed by them. I don't have a real prophet of the Lord besides all this bunch of yes men. Yeah, there's one, but I hate him. Why do you hate him? Well, he never says anything good about me, only bad. Don't stop like that. Send for him. Oh, all right, if you insist. Officer, go get and bring here Micaiah, the son of Imlah. He's a true prophet of the Lord. So the officer goes to get him. It isn't clear with Micaiah in jail or merely in his own humble dwelling on the other side of the tracks, but he goes to get him and has to bring him to a cross town. And on the way, he undertakes to coach him. Micaiah, we've got visiting royalty here. Two kings waiting here for you. Couldn't you be positive just for once? You always have to be negative and against things that other people are in favor of. Now, couldn't you be nice about it and be in favor of something just for once? All these prophets have declared in favor of going to Ramoth-Gilead. Now, don't pour cold water on it by saying no. Man, what the Lord tells me to speak, that's what I'll speak, neither more nor less. So that's that. They get there. Ahab says, Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle or not? These prophets have declared in favor of it. What do you say? Go up and prosper. The Lord will deliver it into the king's hand. This is heavy sarcasm. Micaiah, how often do I have to tell you to speak truth in the name of the Lord? Oh, truth, Ahab. Why didn't you mention that before? Interested in truth this morning. All right. I saw a vision. And all Israel was scattered on the hills like sheep without a shepherd. And there came a voice out of the sky that said, these have no master. Let them return, every one to his own house in peace. This means if Ahab goes there, he'll be killed. You see, Jehoshaphat, I told you he wouldn't say anything good about me. Now, at this point, Jehoshaphat should have pocketed his pride and backed out, but he didn't. He committed only a token force, but he went himself. Ahab said to the officer, put this fellow in prison and feed him with the bread of affliction and the water of affliction. That means stale water and moldy bread. So I get back after capturing Ramoth-Gilead. So the officer takes poor Micaiah away to put him in jail. And Micaiah leans back over his shoulder and says, Ahab, you ever come back from this one? I'm not a prophet and God never spoke by me. All you people, just mark those words. They're going to be fulfilled. And he gets thrown in prison. Now then, they went to the battle. And Ahab says to Jehoshaphat, I have a plan for this battle. If the bell rings, hold it a few seconds and we're finished. I have a plan. You go in just in your royal robes and I'll go in disguise as an ordinary soldier. I'll be riding a chariot with bow and arrows and a chariot driver, just like hundreds of others. And you'll go in your royal robes. All right, Ahab. Now I wonder, is he simple in the head or has he been buttered up to the point where he simply can't say no? He agrees to this crazy plan. And he does this and he almost got killed. He had a narrow brush with death but escaped, and a soldier on the Syrian side shot an arrow at a venture. Not aiming at anybody, just sitting there where the enemy is. It hit Ahab between a crack in the two parts of his suit of armor, penetrated his chest. He says to his chariot driver, now Ahab's a wicked man, but no coward. Drive me out of the battle, I'm sore wounded. And this man drives him off to the side and he props himself up in the chariot and watches the battle as he slowly bleeds to death. And when the sun goes down, he drops dead at the bottom of the chariot. Now they took him back to the other side of the Jordan to bury him, and they took back that chariot. And the chariot was too expensive to throw away just because it had a lot of his blood on it. So a soldier was given the grim job of cleaning that chariot, and he took it to the pond of Jezreel, where Naboth had been stoned. And the dogs, the fierce wild animals belong to nobody, they gathered in, smelled blood, and licked the blood on that chariot.